Disclaimer. Any supposed facts or observations contained therein are attributed to the speaker and do not necessarily imply the endorsement of the podcasters or their affiliates. Does that sound right? I didn't sound like I said it right. Oh well, let's run with it. Cut.
Hello out there in Radioland, and welcome to One Track Mind, the only commentary podcast that matters because, as far as I know, it's the only one. My name is Ryan Luis Rodriguez, a born-again cinephile, and your host for this series where every week we're going to analyze film through the prism of audio commentaries, features without which the entire medium of podcasting would not exist. Directors, writers, actors, and craftspeople analyzing their own films in front of a microphone set the stage for the current culture, and it's about damn time someone showed the proper appreciation. If that sounds too stuffy, I promise there will be jokes. I'm not promising that there will be good jokes, but there will be jokes all the same. This week is the second installment of a trilogy of sorts, the three commentaries recorded by John Carpenter and his muse, legendary actor Kurt Russell, continuing with a full-blown masterpiece, 1982's The Thing. Last week, we filled you in on the backstory for Mr. Carpenter, from attending USC and making the hybrid student thesis slash theatrical film Dark Star in 1973, through meeting Kurt Russell on the television film Elvis in 1978. After that aired, the two teamed up again in 1981 with Escape from New York, a little surprise that grosses more than $25 million on a budget of just $6 million. A success like that ensures a director gets another bite at the apple. But while Escape from New York was essentially an independent production for Avco Embassy Pictures, with his next film, Carpenter would graduate to the majors, namely Universal Pictures, who have been trying to make a new version of Howard Hawks' 1951 film, The Thing from Another World, specifically aiming on adapting the original source material, John W. Campbell's 1938 novella, Who Goes There? As we addressed last week when touching upon Assault in Precinct 13, which is a remake of sorts of Hawks' masterpiece Rio Bravo, a film for which Carpenter contributes audio commentary on the eventual DVD release, Carpenter is big into Hawks and big into The Thing. In fact, the child Jamie Lee Curtis is babysitting in Halloween watches The Thing at one point in the film. Carpenter had come close to making a new Thing since at least 1976, but at that point had only made Assault on his own and was deemed too much of an independent director. Universal proceeded instead with Toby Hooper, who eventually loses favor with the studio. Carpenter becomes part of the conversation again after the stellar financial success of Halloween. But the auteur was reluctant to take the job for two reasons. One, he found the monster in the original underwhelming as it's, quote, just a guy in a suit, unquote, something he reiterates in the Thing commentary. And two, he would be trying to improve upon one of his cinematic idols and found it to be nearly insurmountable. By 1981, when The Thing went into principal photography, Carpenter had shed his anxieties and committed to the film, bringing on his Escape from New York star Kurt Russell and enlisting his longtime cinematographer Dean Cundey, who is his usual muscular self, and practical makeup and creature effects from Rob Bottin. Bottin had racked up positive notices from Carpenter's own film The Fog and Joe Dante's The Howling, for which he replaced Rick Baker when Baker departed to do makeup for his dream project, John Landis's An American Werewolf in London. By summer 1982, Carpenter brings the world the definitive practical effects anti-blockbuster, The Thing.
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
The plot of The Thing is pretty economical and essential. In Antarctica, American researchers brave the blistering cold and dissension in their ranks when an alien organism infests their base camp, an organism that can assimilate human beings and transform and replace them. It's up to the men, dudes rather, to determine who among them is the alien and rid the world of its nefarious plans, which becomes increasingly difficult due to the camp's culture of paranoia and internal distrust. Carpenter and Russell recorded their commentary 13 years after the fact for the 1995 Universal Laserdisc, and it's arguably the most enjoyable of the commentary trilogy. That's partly attributable to the fact that it's the best movie of the bunch, by a wide margin, but also partially attributable to the chip on Carpenter and Russell's shoulders. Both men are clearly still smarting from the negative reception to the film, which we'll touch upon later in this episode. That's not to say that they don't have fun, though. Carpenter and Russell really seem to bring it out of each other in a way that makes them seem like real cool cats to hang out with.
This line here is my favorite.
You gotta be fucking kidding.
Oh, man.
I wish I could ever have as much fun as Kurt Russell has watching his own movie. I don't even listen to this podcast once I'm done recording it, and if I did, I would spend the entire time wincing, wondering, why do you have to sound so nasal? Or, you call that a joke? And although I find Carpenter in general to be a very frustrating commentary subject due to his tendency to simply describe what's happening on screen.
Peter Maloney and Richard Dysart are in this scene together, and both very fine actors.
Tom Waits.
And here comes
Wilford.
Will Brimley, who is one of the great all-time people.
It's not to say that he doesn't have plenty of interesting things to say. Auteurs as inherently fascinating as Carpenter, just in terms of material and in terms of aesthetic strengths, will always find ways to justify talking about his movie into a microphone. Some of my favorite stuff involves his choices as a visual artist, getting to the heart of directing in ways that most filmmakers never illuminate in even their best tracks. For instance, he spends a lot of time explaining just how hard it is to block scenes. If you watch The Thing, you would never guess that, in a film with some of the goopiest effects in film history, that the real struggle Carpenter faced involved having a cast of 10 to 12 actors standing around in scenes and trying to make shots feel dynamic and interesting. We tend to take things like this for granted as audience members, probably because people don't really know exactly what a director does, but commentaries like these really manage to peel back the curtain in ways that I find intensely interesting. At several junctions, he just sits back and allows himself to be impressed by his own work with the ensemble, because on the day he shot these scenes, he had no idea how to stage them. Sometimes scenes with people sitting or standing around talking are easily the least interesting, but not so in the case of The Thing. Carpenter even explains that cinematographer Dean Cundey was aiming to reinforce reality in the enclosed sets, which Carpenter ultimately did away with, and again, you would never think about it in a million years.
There's a lot of problems you had to solve in this movie to isolate them and be realistic. Beautiful lighting in this scene, here's the shot I'm talking about as we come back and let Keith pull us around and pull behind Will, since he was against the wall. Dean was afraid the audience would know what we did. I said, well, it doesn't really matter.
We gotta do it.
Let's do it anyway.
The political subtext is also worth mentioning, as the original Thing was produced at the start of the 1950s, as McCarthyism was on the rise and people were starting to accuse their friends and neighbors of being evil communists, and Carpenter's Thing was released at the start of the Reagan administration, which was once again fighting the evil empire without a hint of irony. And yet, one is not necessarily referencing the other. Carpenter's version isn't about political paranoia because the other one was. It simply reflected the time in which it was made, just as Hawks' version did. It allows the adaptations to be companion pieces in a way, referencing two very different climates in completely different ways while still retaining enough emotional continuity. I'm not sure if I could think of any movie that utilizes Cold War paranoia better than Carpenter's version, given that, by the time the film's conclusion arrives, only Russell's MacReady and my hero Keith David's Childs have survived the Thing's grasp, and even Carpenter is unsure whether or not either man is in fact the Thing. When even your chief creative influence doesn't know if an organism is real or not, you have truly delivered on your promise of paranoia. The Thing was also being produced as the media was beginning to address the AIDS epidemic, which was not a concern during the writing stage, but became intrinsically intertwined with the years that followed. And speaking of the aforementioned goopy effects, no conversation of The Thing would be complete without addressing the aforementioned work of the aforementioned Rob Bottin, truly the best of its breed by a wide margin. There's that phrase again. Carpenter originally thought of the titular Thing as a singular organism, and it was Bottin's masterstroke decision to have the creature constantly evolving as it took the form of various creatures, from dogs on the compound to the researchers themselves. He made things even more interesting by suggesting that the Thing display attributes from every planet it has encountered and every form of life it's assimilated, allowing it to appear literally otherworldly. And let's not forget the goop. Bottin's effects utilize every goopy trick in the books, using ingredients from Twinkies, KY jelly, creamed corn, microwave bubblegum, and even mayonnaise. If that sounds completely nauseating, that's because it was. At one point, Carpenter points out that his actors didn't have to pretend to be grossed out by their frequent scene partners.
As you can see Will Brimley reacting, he's being truthful in his reaction.
I was going to say, this is one of those scenes, too, where it's an eight-man acting contest. Who can act like it smells the worst? And everybody was thinking that. And then when he pulled that thing off, it was pretty rugged.
And yet you guys are still there. You're still
hanging
over it. Because this smoke is extremely pungent. They've changed it now in these sensitive times when people can't handle cigarette smoke anymore.
Fun fact. Bottin really overextended himself during principal photography, resulting in double pneumonia and a bleeding ulcer, even being hospitalized for exhaustion. Fellow practical effects wizard Stan Winston, best known for creating the evil Terminator endoskeleton from, yes, the Terminator, and the T-Rex from Jurassic Park, stepped in to help his friend. The scene he most contributed to involved the Thing assimilating a host of dogs, which was originally planned to be a mechanized effect, which Winston elected to accomplish via hand puppets. But that's not to say that the complicated mechanized effects were not implemented. The final creature, which Bottin did work on, took 50 people to operate, and it was even a last-minute effect. Never could someone watch this film and guess that anything, could possibly be last minute. Everything feels so completely designed and considered, and it's a testament to the artistry of Bottin and his collaborators. There is a scene about halfway through the film where Russell's character, the Take Charge MacReady, devises a method to test the blood of everyone in the camp to see if they are indeed the alien organism, drawing blood from each man and igniting it with a flamethrower. Carpenter notes on the track that for some people, the shots of blood being withdrawn via hypodermic needle tended to freak out audience members more than any of the goopiest effects in the film. It's something I can confirm for myself as well. I know for a fact that the alien ripping its own face open and wrapping its gooey tendrils across its unwilling human or animal hosts is fake, but you stick a needle in someone's arm and all of a sudden your film becomes a documentary. Sure, there were ways to fake it, but according to Carpenter, those shots were not, in fact, faked, and instead a crew member substituted his own arm for that of the acting ensemble. Watch today, especially after having survived the currently still active COVID-19 pandemic, the cabin fever on display in The Thing seems almost quaint, but the film still packs a punch. I've seen it probably 4 or 5 times, and its general gnarliness an anti-authoritarian streak still managed to impress. Getting to see it remastered on 4K Blu-ray is a revelation of its own, and if you've never seen the film before, and why would you listen to this if you haven't, this is the ideal way to experience it. Goop in crystal clarity is essential. Despite being one of the defining horror films of the decade, released in possibly the greatest year for genre cinema, 1982, The Thing was not very well received in the moment. On a budget of $15 million, it grosses just under $20. For those who don't play the budget game, a movie is considered profitable if it grosses twice its budget. Since you're a smart person and you know math, clearly that's not a ginormous hit. Part of the problem is its general pessimism and downbeat tone, which is greatly compounded by the fact that just 2 weeks earlier, the same studio, Universal, releases the biggest box office smash of the decade, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, another more feel-good alien movie that wipes the floor with The Thing. You would think that the studio would have sensed that this was an issue ahead of time, but if they did, they certainly didn't act on it. Another part of the problem was the immediate critical reception, which compared it unfavorably to E.T. and even another alien-themed film from earlier in the summer, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Go figure. The effects were described as repulsive, which was entirely the point, only they weren't using repulsive in a positive fashion. Now you may be wondering, Ryan, when is repulsive ever a positive? And I would merely shake my head in your direction. Carpenter even points out that he was deliberately draining the story of most humor and levity to bring gravity to what could easily just be a creepy creature feature. Everything in the film was trying to be, it was shamed for being. Hell, even the musical score received a Razzie nomination, and it was by Ennio goddamn Morricone. It wasn't until at least a decade later that the film received the reappraisal it deserved, and by then, it was considered a cult classic, which is all fair and good, but doesn't really do its makers any favors. There is no consolation prize for making something brilliant and having it so poorly received for years. I'm sure it eventually feels good, but man, it smarts initially. For years, I was terrified of watching the film, again contributing to my previous admissions of being a puss, mainly because it was responsible for the most traumatic clips played during Universal Orlando's horror makeup show, but I never put together how badly the film was received. After all, why would they give such visibility and real estate to something that was perceived as something so distasteful? But that really shows you how the discourse eventually evolved. A few decades after its release, The Thing continued to have an influence on cinema, whether it was the frankly underrated 2011 prequel, also called The Thing, which is not great by any stretch of the imagination, but surprisingly interesting, or Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, a similarly miserable snowbound experience dealing in paranoia, also co-starring Kurt Russell, even utilizing unused tracks from Morricone's original score. The financial failure of the film gets Carpenter booted off his next project, the Stephen King adaptation Firestarter. Now, in the grand scheme of things, that's not so bad. When Firestarter is eventually made and released in 1984, it earns even less than The Thing and is denounced by King himself as, quote, flavorless, unquote. Carpenter instead proceeds to make another King adaptation, 1983's Christine, which is a minor success and, like The Thing, earns a solid cult reputation. In 1984, he makes the gentler alien-centered drama Starman, for which he acknowledges as his penance for making The Thing. Naturally, despite being a more commercial effort, it flops at the box office. It's just impossible for this dude to catch a break! His next film, reuniting the director with his muse Kurt Russell, is similarly a flop, but that will have to wait until next week when we wrap up this Carpenter-Russell trilogy and get into some big trouble in Little China. But before we wrap up, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's Ryan's recommendations. John Carpenter considers The Thing to be the first chapter of his so-called apocalypse trilogy, meaning stories of thematic similarity with bleak endings, and my recommendations this week concern those other films. First up, a movie I have been not able to separate from my subconscious or my waking nightmares since I first saw it on DVD from Netflix, Remember when Netflix was a DVD service? Good times. In high school, and that's 1987's Prince of Darkness. This was part of a multi-picture deal that Carpenter signed with Alive Films that allowed him complete creative control if he could bring each film in for $3 million or less. And if there's any director that I trust to maximize the value of meager sums, it's John Carpenter. This is the guy who invented the modern slasher genre with less than $500,000, so clearly he knows what he's doing. Speaking of Halloween, Prince of Darkness reunites Carpenter with his frequent star Donald Pleasance and even Big Trouble in Little China co-stars Dennis Dunn and Victor Wong. But beyond any actor in the film, the point of Prince of Darkness is Carpenter's muscular, if not understated, command of his aesthetic. Despite not having more than a couple nickels to rub together, he's created a genuine vision of the apocalypse that will continue to transfix and astound for years to come. The conclusion of the Apocalypse trilogy arrived around the midpoint of the 1990s with In the Mouth of Madness, easily the most interesting film Carpenter made in the entire decade by a wide margin. Again with that wide margin shit, why do I keep doing that? It follows Sam Neill as an insurance investigator tracking the disappearance of a Stephen King-like author before experiencing some waking nightmares of his own and eventually losing his sanity in the process. It's a film that eventually leads to a final scene that stands as meta as anything Carpenter has ever done, and if anything else he made in the entire decade matched its level of quality, it would have been a prosperous time indeed. But they didn't, and it wasn't. We usually have three recommendations in each of these episodes, so we need one more film. I decided to include a film that, were The Thing never made, would easily fit into the Apocalypse trilogy, 1988's They Live. Hear me out. Aliens have hypnotized humanity into blindly worshiping their social status quo, but when one man stumbles upon a pair of sunglasses that pierce the veil and reveal their insidious subliminal messaging, like dollar bills saying, "This is your God," he takes the first steps of a brave new world. This is easily one of Carpenter's most interesting and definitely idiosyncratic films, to the point that I may appreciate it more than any of his other 80s output aside for The Thing, and that's all the more surprising considering that the only thing that could have made it better is by substituting Kurt Russell for Rowdy Roddy Piper. That's not to say that Piper does a bad job. I'm not sure anyone could sell the line, "I've come to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum," but Piper certainly does. It's got a great undercurrent of humor and a real nasty streak, and it feels epic, despite costing only a fifth of The Thing's $15 million budget, so if we were renaming Carpenter's triptych as the Apocalypse Quadrilogy, it would fit in nicely. Prince of Darkness and They Live are currently available in sterling 4K editions from the beautiful Twisted Minds at Scream Factory, and In the Mouth of Madness is available from the same distributor on Blu-ray. For more reviews and recommendations, check out my Letterboxd page at letterboxd.com/onetrackmind. That'll do it for this week. Is there anything I overlooked? Reach out to me at onetrackmindpod on Twitter, one that is the numeral one trackmindpodcast on Instagram, on Podchaser, or send an email to onetrackmindpodcast@gmail.com. If you enjoy what you hear, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or the source of your choice. Positive feedback helps keep the show alive, and I want to keep making it until it just isn't fun anymore. Special thanks to the amazing Lacey Barker for the podcast artwork, Bill Sherm for our original themes, and special thanks to our equally amazing patrons. Case A, Catherine H, Ellen I, Kathleen D, Izzy T, Bobby L, Michael A, Ian C, Ian M, Kitty K, Kelly B, The Vern, Mary M, Bill M, Christopher H, and Tracy R. Thanks for listening, and until next time, you're gonna cut that, right?
Darn, that's the end.